Welcome to the Love Justice Podcast, where we hear from different voices who are joining us in the fight against modern-day slavery. Please welcome today's guests, Kirk Schweitzer and Austin Fleischer.
Well, hey, welcome to the Love Justice Podcast. We are so excited about this episode where we get to hang out together as two organizations, IJM and LJI. We'll talk more about that here in just a second. But Hannah, so good to be with you again. How are you doing?
Yeah, we're reunited after a couple weeks.
Reunited and it feels so good. All right, so there you go. That's all we'll do of singing for the episode. But go ahead and introduce our guests for us.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I say this every episode, but our listeners are in for a real treat. We have a returning guest, Kirk Schweitzer, from LJI program staff, and an extra special guest and friend of Love Justice today, Austin Fleischer. So welcome, guys. Why don't we just go ahead and just have you start by introducing yourselves and explain your roles at your prospective organizations.
Great. I'm happy to go. My name is Austin, and I'm a recruiter at International Justice Mission, or IJM. I started at IJM 10 years ago as an intern in a couple of our offices located in East Africa. And then I was hired onto our HR team in Washington, D.C., where our global headquarters is. And then I transitioned after a couple of years on the HR team over to our global programs team. And then for the past several years, I've actually been back on the HR team supporting expatriate staff and recruiting for positions in the U.S. and other regions around the world.
Cool. Awesome. And I'm Kirk Schweitzer. I started with Love Justice just over 10 years ago, moved to Kathmandu, Nepal, and joined our anti-trafficking program staff team, and have now shifted into the role of chief of staff with the organization and now live in South Africa, where we're kind of establishing a new program headquarters here.
Yeah, we have some similarities between the two of you being with both of your organizations as long as you have been. Just tell me, what motivated you to get into this work in the first place? I feel like that probably has to be connected to both of your longevities.
I can go first on this one. When I think of kind of what motivated me and I think back, I start thinking about some of the experiences I had in school. I studied abroad, actually in Uganda. Austin, you mentioned your time in Uganda. Uganda has a special place in my heart from studying abroad there. I had a couple experiences that just opened my eyes up to a world that I wasn't familiar with growing up in the Midwest, and in a really cool way. It also opened up my eyes to the church and how God was at work around the world. And it was through those experiences that I just wanted to be a part of that in some way. Cool connection to IJM is part of my kind of understanding and learning about human trafficking. And I think there's so many stories like this, was from reading, and particularly reading a book of Gary Haugen's called Terrify No More. And I can basically still remember the moment and the emotion that came when I read a chapter in that book where he's describing the nature of human trafficking in a particular area of the world, but also more broadly. And there's a chapter called Where Were You? And in that chapter, he's reflecting on what that question is, kind of the question that our grandchildren will ask us when they realize that there's the context of human trafficking, is they're reflecting on their past. They'll be asking us, where were you in that context? And that question stood out to me so much. And he ends that chapter saying, I hope we can say that we showed up, and that we showed up on time. And I just remember feeling like, okay, I've got to do something. I can't not know what's going on. I've got to get involved. So I've always been a huge supporter of IJM, loved the work there, and was that Gary Haugen and his writing played a big part in me getting in this track.
That's great. I love that, Kirk. I feel like we do have a lot of similarities, even with the story of how we first got involved. During college, I was at a conference, and similarly, I heard a story of a survivor of trafficking. And I also grew up in a pretty comfortable bubble in the US, and that story was my first exposure to the brutal reality of violence that exists in the world. And at the time, I was introduced to both the work of Love Justice and of IJAM. And after that conference, I think Gary Haugen, the CEO of IJAM and founder, I think he also spoke at that conference and asked the same question. When our grandkids ask us, where were you when this everyday violence and slavery is happening? What were you doing? And so after the conference, I went home. I researched both organizations. I noticed that Love Justice had a trip for people to visit Nepal for 6 weeks to see really up close, one, the culture in Nepal that Love Justice is working in, and then two, the problem that they're addressing and how they're addressing it. And so I went on that trip. I was introduced to a few people who used to work for IJAM. When I returned from that trip and was nearing college graduation, I found myself researching IJAM again. And so I applied and got accepted to a year-long internship in East Africa, where I spent time both in Zambia and in Uganda. And then I've been on staff with them ever since, but very similar story to you, Kirk.
Austin, I think we might have been at the same conference because not that we're asking me the answer to this question, but it's very connected to what you just said. And so it's for our listeners, it was the Passion 2012 and 2013 conferences. Like if you wanted to go back and hear Gary's talks, I think they're very powerful. And we've had so many people in our recruiting process that reference that experience as being what catapulted them into this work, which I'm sure you guys at IJAM hear something very similar.
Yes, for sure. It was those conferences. I was there both of those years. And so you went to IJAM, I went to LJI, and then we flip-flopped where you went to Love Justice and I came to IJAM.
Yeah. So powerful that one, you know, conversation can have such a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No doubt. That conference, Gary's writings, I mean, there were so many amazing things happening in that season that prompted and compelled you guys and many others to get involved. And both of these organizations are doing really amazing work, right? International Justice Mission, Love Justice International, and yet they do different type of work in this anti-trafficking world. And so you guys talk about that a little bit, like how are they similar? How are they different? You know, but both really meaningful and significant.
Yeah, I can talk about IJAM. So our mission is to protect people in poverty from violence. And so we believe that when perpetrators of violence are held accountable for their crimes, that then the prevalence of that crime will decrease and that there will then be a population of people who are protected from ever experiencing violence. And so depending on what jurisdictions we're working in, we're either working on cases of police abuse of power, violence against women and children, or slavery. And we have offices all over the world. And in each of those offices, we hire local investigators, lawyers, social workers who take on these cases of violence, push them through the local justice systems. And what that helps us do is diagnose the gaps of the reasons why perpetrators of violence are not being held accountable. And so then we then respond to those gaps in the justice system by partnering with the government to build up their justice system, to respond to the slavery and violence that's happening so that survivors of violence are restored, perpetrators of violence are held accountable, and ultimately resulting in the protection of people from ever experiencing violence because potential perpetrators understand there will be a consequence for their violence. And so I'd love to hear from you, Kirk, how you think some of the work that you guys are doing at Love Justice are complementary to some of that. I'm not as familiar with some of the work that Love Justice has been doing for the past 10 years or so. And I know it's evolved a lot since I was there 12 years ago.
Yeah, that's cool, Austin. I think we've always, kind of thinking about this question, I think we've always very clearly understood that when you're tackling something as big as human trafficking, global human trafficking around the world, this isn't like a one strategy fits every situation or one strategy is just going to solve it. And so I think we've always thought that our piece of this puzzle was exactly that. It was a piece. And so cool to see so many different organizations around the world kind of attacking it in different ways. I love the ways that the path that IJAM has taken. It's been even cool to watch from afar in some ways, kind of how they've evolved and changed and so admire how they pioneered this space. As we think about the primary methods in this kind of ecosystem of organizations that are working to fight against human trafficking, I think we would recognize two pretty broad, I'll paint in some broad strokes here, two pretty broad strategies. One would be what I would describe as pre-trafficking efforts. And so awareness, job creation, really kind of with the intention to stop it before it happens. And then the latter would be the post-trafficking. And it's the organizations that, you know, you need to rescue the people who are currently enslaved. And so it's investigation strategies, it's rescues, it's aftercare. And in terms of how our work, which our primary strategy is transit monitoring, we've just seen that there's this gap, there's this space kind of in between that pre-trafficking, post-trafficking strategies where transit monitoring fits in. And again, it's not to say that it's better or either one of these shouldn't be done, but we just have recognized there's this space, and maybe for many years there's been little attention on this space. But we've just found it to be a very strategic time to get involved at the moment that someone's being trafficked, and to have monitors out searching, looking for, identifying red flags at the moment somebody is actively moving into that situation of human trafficking. We kind of internally, this isn't meant to be a legal definition or replace anything like that, but internally we just simply define human trafficking as moving someone into slavery. And so it's that point of movement that we have kind of honed in with our strategy, that's the point we're looking to find someone at, that point of movement, so that we can stop them from reaching that final destination of slavery in whatever form that takes.
That's great.
That's really good. And it's amazing how, like you said, Kurt, both are needed, both approaches are needed. We recognize that. And yet what has been really special is to see the work of IJM continue to flourish, be impactful. And in these last few years, to see the work of LGI begin to really grow in its impact. And as we're amplifying that story, people, I think, are thankful for both, right? For both approaches. You know, as we talk about and we share that story, I sometimes actually have had people here in the States say, is human trafficking really a problem? Right? Like they hear us talk about it and they think, you know, this is so cool what you do, but is that really an issue? Is it really a problem in the world today? And if, like, so can you guys talk about that? Like, what is it a problem? Which I think we all on this know the answer to that, but for our listeners and our viewers, is it a problem? And why is it so difficult to combat?
Yeah, I can just share a quick first comment. The first thing I would say is I think, you know, you see probably in the world today, we want to understand it. There's different attempts to understand it, to try and calculate how many slaves are there today. And it's so difficult. What's so tricky with trafficking, it's a hidden crime. It takes place in the dark. And so the reality is we don't know how many people are affected by it. I think that's the most honest thing I can say, you know, to that question, is we don't know. But looking at all the estimates that are out there, and maybe each one has its pros and cons and maybe even flaws in how they're, but attempting to describe how many people are currently slaves today, we don't know. And yet the best estimates are that it involves tens of millions of people in modern day slavery today. And so that for that reason, and knowing, again, going back to that definition of trafficking, that what we're talking about is somebody being moved into slavery. That is what makes tens of millions of people that have been moved into slavery, regardless of what that number is exactly, that places this among one of the world's greatest injustices, we believe.
Yeah, I agree, Kirk. It really is hard to estimate, but it is probably tens of millions of people. I think what makes it really hard to combat is there's a lot of financial incentivization and power incentivization. I think it's also estimated that I think $150 billion a year is generated from human trafficking. Two-thirds of that being, I think, from commercial sexual exploitation. I think what makes it really hard to combat is some of those incentives that people have. And it really requires government ownership and the ability of the government to increase the performance of the justice system by rescuing, restoring, and holding people who are perpetrating this violence, holding them accountable. And it's just not easy to build up the justice system capacity. It requires a significant monetary investment, training for many members of the justice system, including police, lawyers, social workers, judges, And it's just a lot of different people who are involved. And so trying to put together a functioning justice system just isn't easy.
Yeah. And I think the next question that kind of precedes, is human trafficking real? Is how could someone allow themselves to be in that situation? Or how do they find themselves in a situation where they're trafficked? And you both are so unique in that you've spent time in the field. And so you've probably seen the vulnerabilities up close and personal as to how that could happen. So I'm hoping that each of you could just share with our listeners about different examples of what might be going on in someone's life that makes them a target for a trafficker.
Yeah, I think I'd be interested to hear some of what Kirk would say. I think in for a lot of IJM cases, the vast majority of trafficking victims come from desperate economic situations and are more likely to take risks to accept a vague job offer that promises some quick cash. False debts are commonly used to trap laborers in a cycle of debt that's designed to be impossible to pay back. Those are some of the most common cases I've seen, is with people who are in just really desperate economic situations, trying to do anything to put food on the table, to send their kids to school, take care of their family members who might be ill, cases like that.
Yeah, I agree with that, Austin. We have this understanding that any place that we're going to do transit monitoring, we need to be flexible to adapt our model to fit that context and the realities there on the ground. But I would say the one really consistent thing we've found is that the really common narrative is exactly what you're describing. It's people that are in search of job opportunities and traffickers preying on that. And it's hard to really put yourself in the shoes of those people and what they would be willing to risk for their family. And when a job opportunity that maybe it's too good to be true, they see maybe some of the flags or some of the concerns, but I think it's very difficult for us to imagine what it could be like to be in their shoes with no other options or opportunities. But that's certainly what we see across many, many countries is that narrative.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think, like, I would just love to hear from both of you, where have each of your organizations had some success? We talked about how it's difficult to combat the nuances of it, but in that same vein, I know that both LJI and IJM have incredible impact stories, and would just love to hear one or two of them.
Cool. I can jump in. I'm eager to hear from Austin on this one as well, but I'll just jump in quick. Last month, we actually had an intercept record. So it's a timely question. We had an intercept record. When we intercept a potential victim who's being trafficked, it's because our teams on the ground have determined that there's either evidence of trafficking on right now, or there's a very high risk of trafficking. And we've got a process for determining that and verifying that impact before we would count it. But last month, we crossed 2,000 intercepts for the first time. Our previous monthly intercept record, I believe, was 1,800 and some change. And we actually hit 2,300. And I should know the exact number, but it was just over 2,300. So we actually smashed our previous intercept record, which was pretty cool. And the other piece of that our impact that I would say as an organization we are hyper-focused on is impact on the dollar, looking to see what does it cost us to achieve this impact and how do we continue to become more efficient as an organization. One of our values is to do much with little. And so a global value that's connected to that is to define, measure, and allocate by impact. We want all of our resources, whatever limited resources we have, to be allocated in a way that's going to create the greatest possible impact. And so we track impact very closely and we measure it on the dollar. And one of the one-year goals that we've had for the last 2 years, it was a one-year goal both years, we achieved in the last couple months, and we wanted to hit $120 an intercept. And we hit 117 just a couple months ago, which was a huge, huge milestone for us. And so we were so excited about that. To be able to intercept somebody that we believe and prevent them from being trafficked for $117, we just felt like is a really cool, incredible impact. Austin, I'm so excited. IJM had such an impact. We'd love to hear more about what you guys are up to.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thanks for sharing that. I hadn't known all of the success that LJI has seen. So it's very exciting to hear. As a recruiter for IJM, I talk to candidates all the time and I tell them about the work that we're doing. And this is one of my favorite things to talk about. So when IJM starts a program, we work with the third party company to conduct a baseline survey to tell us the prevalence of the particular type of violence that exists in a jurisdiction. And then at the end of a program, we do the same thing to see, has our program made any progress? We also measure by results. One of my favorite things about IJM that we've been talking about for the last year is that we've closed 9 projects over the last decade that have shown a decrease in slavery and violence between 50 and 85% for very large populations of people in poverty. Just really quite unbelievable results. And that's 50 to 85% of very large populations of people living in poverty who no longer have to experience slavery and violence due to a working justice system that's holding people accountable. Mm-hmm. People have a confidence in that the justice system will work. If they call a police officer or call somebody in the justice system, they know that, that people will be held accountable. I think a very specific example is most recently one of these third party companies who helped us conduct an N-line survey in the Indian state of Tamil Nadu. It's a huge state, 70 million people live there. I think that's the population of both Texas and California combined, just a state in India. And it's notoriously burdened by slave labor. And the third party judges found that IJM's project had reduced slavery in that state by 82%. So I think that's 380,000 people who were moved from slavery to freedom over those years. And that's so much more people who are protected from ever experiencing that type of slavery or violence. So just very exciting things that we've seen.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, hearing both, like, right, hearing what you guys are up to and some of those figures in those contexts, hearing and knowing what we're up to, LJI, it's just amazing. I love that we get to partner in this, we get to do this and attack this together. When you've got that kind of success and you're having that kind of impact, obviously those who are committed to human trafficking, not committed to anti-trafficking work, but committed to actual human trafficking, are going to change and adjust, right? They're going to adapt. They're going to figure out new ways, which means that our organizations have to also figure out new ways. So, like, you guys talk about that for just a minute, about how the landscape of human trafficking, you see it changing currently and how you think it will be changing over the next decade.
That's a challenging one. We're talking about an unknown future, but I'll just take a stab at it, Jason. Austin, I love hearing about just the scientific approach that IJM is taking there. And that's something that we've really felt like we've wanted to continue to lean into ourselves and grow in that space ourselves in our own ways. And I think, and I'll connect it to this answer, Jason, of that. I think more and more we're the organizations that are working to fight against human trafficking, like you heard from Austin, and we're getting smarter, and we're finding more innovative scientific ways to really demonstrate impact, and that's going to just continue. I think there's going to be even more innovation brought to this space to combat human trafficking, and I think there needs to be probably more models and more ideas for how to push back on those incentives Austin was talking about, how to identify victims, how to create job. There's so many different ways and opportunities, I think. And it's going to be this combined push in all these different directions that I think would reshape the landscape. I'll say from our perspective, because we see this space, because we see this moment, this strategic moment when people are being moved, we're looking to create an alliance of partners that are interested in doing transit monitoring. And so that's something that we look forward to in the future of seeing that come to bear in different countries and different organizations and partnerships. And we're excited to think about what the impact of that could be.
That's great. I don't have much to add to that on, but I do agree that we'll have to continue to be innovative. One of my favorite things about IJM is that we are pretty quick to pivot to address the results that we're trying to achieve. I think LJI, I've seen from a distance over the last several years, is also very similar, which is something that I like about both of our organizations, is that we are quick to pivot when things need to change. We don't just get stuck in trying to do a certain thing that we think must be the fix to the problem. But I think similarly to Kirk, what I see in hope in the future, especially looking back at IJM's programming, I'm just excited for to take what we've learned over the last 25 years and to figure out what pieces of our program are the most important, what exact pieces of these really robust programs have led to a reduction in the prevalence of these crimes, and taking those and leveraging those to, I think we've identified 47 jurisdictions that we want to work in over the next decade. We are going after this vision that Gary Haugen, our CEO, has set before us to ensure the protection of 500 million people from violence over the next decade. And we've identified where those jurisdictions are. And so I'm just hopeful that with the results that we've seen, that we can take what we've learned and adapt them within the context of what those jurisdictions need to see the same sort of protection for those people.
Yeah. Austin, something that we've been talking about internally for probably about a year now is just this idea or a vision of a tipping point that could lead to the end of human trafficking. And whatever sort of maybe connected to the financial incentive of like the cost becomes so high to commit that crime that it just maybe slowly starts to decline. That's maybe some of the internal dialogue that we've been having. But I'm curious to hear from both of you of what you think is needed for a tipping point to end human trafficking. And maybe Austin, you can take a stab at that one first.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we know that slavery and trafficking is actually illegal almost everywhere. It's just not the perpetrators know that if they do it, they won't be held accountable. And so I do think that there a tipping point could be, I think, two things. One, justice systems and governments own the ability to hold perpetrators accountable so that people know if they commit this crime, they will serve a sentence in jail. They will pay a really expensive fine, whatever the legal ramifications of that would be. I think another tipping point could be being able to show governments where this has worked before. So in the case of IJM's programs, what are some of jurisdictions where we've actually seen a success in reducing the prevalence of slavery and trafficking, and then taking that to other places and saying, hey, this might not look exactly the same here, but what are some ways that we can use what we've learned from this jurisdiction and just apply that here? I think it's a couple of things, and I'm sure you guys have some great ideas as well.
I'll just add to that. You know, the first thing I think about in response to that question is it's really tipping points. It's really multiple tipping points. And kind of like Austin shared about those examples of prevalence and the decrease, that was a tipping point in those areas, it would seem. That, you know, to have a 50, 60, 70, 80% decrease, IJM found a tipping point and where it was able to influence that in that space. And so there's no such thing probably as a single tipping point for all human trafficking, but it's the combination of many tipping points coming together. And I think it can be done in a lot of the ways that Austin's talking about. And imagine an empowered justice system alongside a transit monitoring strategy where monitors are identifying victims as they're being trafficked and police are in collaboration because they've been empowered and to keep people safe. I think there's a lot of pieces there that if they come together, we will see tipping points that not only just slowly decrease trafficking, but rapidly do so. Because once you hit that tipping point, it suddenly becomes not worth it. And there's, I think there's an understanding, there'd be a sudden change and a sudden decrease in some ways. So yeah, it's a cool thing to think about. And it's a future that I'm very hopeful for as well.
Yeah, can I add one more thing also? I think one of the really exciting things also happening at IJM, or something that we get to be a part of, is one of the things we've been focusing on over the last, I think, 5 years now more than ever, has been incorporating survivors into our programming, incorporating people who are interested in our advocacy strategies. And so there's a really cool project that has happened recently in the Philippines, where the government in the Philippines and a group of survivors of a particular type of violence there, IJM has brought them together to facilitate a conversation of how the government can, the survivors are, they've opted to share their story, and the government has signed an agreement with them that for any policy regarding this particular type of violence, that they will listen to this group of survivors. I think that will also be a tipping point, is for survivors who can and are able and are, who are willing to share their stories with these agents of change. I think that will also be one of the tipping points that we'll start to see.
Austin, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you this earlier. I saw that, I don't know if it was a documentary or if it was something on your socials, that someone, I think it was from the Philippines, please correct me if I'm wrong, but there was someone that helped rescue 20 years ago that just recently visited the IJM offices, got to meet Gary for the first time, got to meet someone else on staff responsible for that. And she's now maybe connected with her own NGO and advocating for people in her own country. And it's like, how can you not get so excited and also moved by stories like that?
Yeah. This is a story of Neri from Cambodia. I think this was in the early days of IJM. She was one of a few girls who were, IJM helped with the local police in Cambodia to rescue out of, I think it was a brothel. Went through whatever the aftercare process looked like then, but never really kept in touch with anybody from IJM. Our team was so small then. But then one day, I think she, I don't know the exact story, you guys should check out the documentary, but she figured out that it was IJM and asked if she could come meet Gary and Sharon Kunwu, who were the people on the ground who had been part of that story. And it's just a really powerful moment where Neri walks into the IJM office and she remembers Sharon, who sat with her in a really vulnerable place before she was placed in whatever her aftercare process looked like. So I really encourage you to check out the documentary. It's just one story. And so if you imagine government officials listening to these people who have experienced horrific violence, how can you not listen to them? How can you not change some of the things that you're doing? So I think that's just a very powerful thing that we can support the efforts of.
Yeah,
it's incredible. I mean, we collect stories just like you guys do, and it feels like every story that I'm able to read through, every story I'm able to share, is just even that much more impactful, motivates people toward change. But to put those together, like to get those victims, those that have been a part of that trauma and affected by that trauma, to talk to the people that are making the policies, I love that. I think those are the kinds of collaborations and the kinds of connections that we've got to keep making more of, and hopefully we can see that tipping point. Austin, I don't know if you saw recently, our CEO sent a link to an article that was in the New York Times about how the human trafficking in Calcutta was affected so significantly because of some of the work that was going on there. And that was even connected not only to rescue, but to border monitoring, transit monitoring concepts. And so the idea, like you guys are saying, of it being multiple tipping points and multiple connections that really move us toward that moment, I think is so powerful. Mm-hmm. So people that are listening, they're watching, they're hearing this, and maybe like you guys, right, at the Passion conferences or when you read Gary's book, maybe they're hearing this and they're thinking, okay, I know I need to do something. And maybe they've heard about this for a long time, but for whatever reason, this just hits a chord. How can people get involved? And Austin, we'll let you jump in first. Like, how can people support IJM? How can they get involved with you guys, and then we can also share a little bit about what that means for LJI too.
Yeah, that's great. I think what I love about IJAM and LJI, I think there are just so many opportunities, different levels of engagement. I think one of the best ways to find out how to get involved with IJAM is going to our website at ijam.org. There's so much great information on there. We love it when people want to be involved with our work, and so we've made it super accessible. That could be from anything of applying to an internship like I did, that's semester-based, or could even include living up to a year in another country, just serving our teams in the field who are doing this really hard work day after day, just going and supporting them in any way that is helpful to them. Also applying to an employee position, becoming a local volunteer. A lot of cities, especially around the US, we have a lot of opportunities to volunteer in order to raise awareness about everyday violence that's happening. And also to become a key partner of IJAM's work by becoming a creative partner and donating to our work on a monthly basis. There's just so many different types of ways to engage, and all of that is on our website at ijam.org.
So Kirk, I'll let you jump in too, and then we can even offer on from our side, on the state side, a few of the new ways that we're working on that people can get involved. But how would you say, you know, just in your own experiences as you've been with us for so long, that you've seen people get involved and support and be a part of the work that LGI is doing?
Yeah, I think I'll say we as an organization, but also I have gotten this question a lot in the last 10 years. You know, somebody finds out about what we do, and the question is, what can I do now? What's my response? And there's, yes, there's opportunities on our website to get involved. There's staffing positions, there's volunteer opportunities, and I encourage you to check it out. But maybe what I would encourage you even more to do would be to be responsible for that little flame, maybe that just caught fire in your heart. Be responsible for it, because it will blow, it will go out if left unnurtured. Mm-hmm. And one of our values at Love Justice is to let injustice break your heart. And nobody wants to do that. I don't want to do that. I daily do not want to face up to injustice. I don't want to engage with it. I want to look the other way. But I challenge you to face it. To face it and let it break your heart. Let it break your heart. And it doesn't mean we just need to sit there, but let it change the trajectory of your life. And it might not mean you're going to go move to South Africa, but maybe it does. Or maybe you're going to move to Uganda with IBM, or maybe it will do that, but maybe it's not. But maybe it changes your life in a different way. Maybe it changes your heart posture and attention towards injustice in a way that I think Christ is calling his church towards. And so that's how I would respond to that question.
Yeah, that's good.
I love it. I think, you know, ijm.org, lovejustice.ngo, and more specifically, lovejustice.ngo/media are where we've got multiple very easily accessible links and spots where you can connect to learn more. And so, you guys, any last words? Hannah, you can wrap it up for us, but any last words from you guys before Hannah wraps it up for us here?
Just that I just want to reiterate, so appreciate the work of International Justice Mission, and can confidently say I would not be here today if it was not for the work of IJAM and being inspired at being just learning about human trafficking today. And so continue to just stand in admiration of the work that is being done there. And so thanks, Austin, for your part in it.
Thanks, Kirk. And similarly, I wouldn't be here without Love Justice. My journey started at Love Justice. And I'm just really grateful for the work there, really grateful to keep in touch with Hannah, who I've known for a long time. And whenever she emails me or sends me a text about something that we can potentially partner on or just brainstorm on, I love it. I love being able to partner with you guys on very formal and informal ways as well, just through these relationships that we have. So I'm just really grateful.
Yeah. This conversation is so encouraging. And I think for someone, you know, for all of us who have been in this work for so long, it's conversations like these that give us a little bit of fuel for the fire of like, yes, like, let's keep going. I got goosebumps multiple times through this conversation. And it's like, I don't know. It's just, I love how the spirit moves in that. And I think, you know, just thank you to both of you guys for the long walk of obedience in the same direction that you both have chosen time and time again. And it's because of that, that you both, not by yourselves, obviously, but both get to celebrate in the successes of both IJM and LJI and have gotten to be a part of that in whatever way that has looked like over the years. So thank you guys for that. And also thank you for being a part of this conversation and just really expectant to see how God continues to move in this space, both from a program perspective, but also from the church. And I just, I can't imagine what it's like to be Gary and just hear how God moved through his talks and his resources and how he just probably was being obedient to what he felt like God was asking. And just the fruit of that is just mind blowing to me and just incredible to think about. So if you see him, Austin, you'll have to send him our regards. But yeah, similar to what Jason, just huge fans of IJM, some of your guys' biggest cheerleaders. I think all of us have some sort of connection to IJM. And yeah, just really, really thankful for you, Austin, and thankful for your time today. And it's great to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed reconnecting with you, Hannah, and getting to meet you, Jason, and Kirk. Thank you so much.
We are grateful for the generous support of the Love Justice community. Please consider joining our family of donors. Learn more at lovejustice.ngo.